You're listening to the Tupten Children Podcast.
Good evening, and we'll start with our motivation. So, we sit here for about a half an hour before these teachings start. And I was reflecting about this topic and how, I guess how it can kind of go in one ear and out the other, certain parts of it. Then I started thinking about why that might be, and I think partly because although we went over the teachings about karma last week, for most of us, they're not so vivid. And even though the Buddha has said that in the whole, the main topics of Precious Garland are about definite goodness or higher rebirth, or high status, which is higher rebirth, and certain goodness, or definite goodness, which is liberation or awakening. We don't really think about ethical conduct in a real way as the cause. I really think that there's a part of our mind that doesn't really buy in. And I was then thinking about how when I was a kid, I used to think about utopias. And I was imagining sitting here what it would be like if no one did any of these 10 non-virtues. I was thinking about all the people I know in prison, and I don't think most of them would be there. And when you turned on the news, looked at your computer, there wouldn't be many stories to read. And when you went out to your garage, you wouldn't have to have locked the door. In fact, your car would be unlocked, you'd just leave the keys in it. And when you wanted to go anywhere at any time of day, you wouldn't have to be fearful. And then most of our advertising and various policies wouldn't be necessary, and most of the laws that we have. And I'm just kind of thinking about the things I can tangibly see, since I don't see the workings of karma. And I was just kind of letting my mind really go to how far, what really would things look like? So then taking that and imagining, if you just did this for yourself, because you can't really control others, but you just you know, what to adopt and what to abandon, and you abandon these 10 non-virtues and adopt the 10 virtues, then what are you creating for your future? So when we do the practice of the meditation of the Buddha, before we do the four immeasurables, we take time to meditate on emptiness and imagine that all environments are pure lands and all beings are Buddhas. And then Venerable, when she wrote this explanation, she said, then, and why isn't that the case? Why is that just in our imagination? And it's because we lack love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. So then just imagine if those were present in our mind. I think that it would be kind of like a pure land. And just imagine what everything would look like to you. Okay, so last week we talked about kind of an introduction to karma, and tonight we're going to talk about the actions of the body and a couple of them of the speech. And so these are kind of organized in these 10 destructive actions. It's kind of a basic arrangement. But it's not just like a way to organize the material. I mean, that's one way. But these 10 actually don't include all of the non-virtues or virtues that we could do. But it's just as we did in that, motivation, just in our imagination, these are kind of the key points that if the most obvious and coarse things among the virtues and non-virtues, they really cover all those kind of categories. But there are definitely more virtues and non-virtues. So we're talking about 3 physical, 4 verbal, and 3 mental actions, which are killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. I'm going to memorize these, right? 4 of speech. Lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle talk, and then 3 of the mind. Coveting, malicious intent, and wrong view. And then the opposite of those is to drop all of those, and also the reverse actions are to protect life, to protect others' property, to use your sexuality wisely and kindly for the body, to speak the truth, to use words that promote harmony, to use words that are kind and gentle, and to speak to a purpose. I see people writing, that's good. And then the mental ones, to rejoice in others' good qualities and be generous, to cultivate the 4 immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity, and to develop conviction in rebirth, Buddha nature, and karma. Those are the mental ones. So, okay, so we're going to go through these in terms of, I want to say that I see the real purpose of this is to help us to look at our own behavior. I mean, especially if you've taken precepts, and especially monastics who have taken a lot of precepts, we're keyed in to looking at our behaviors, and these precepts are very helpful for us to figure out, to really look at our actions. And so it's the same for looking at these 4 branches of these 10 actions. There's 4 branches that make an action or a karma complete, and so I'm going to review that, but I think the main thing is this is a really helpful way for us to look at our actions and to kind of tease apart what we're doing with our body, with our speech, and with our mind. It helps us actually to become much more discerning with the nuances of our complex psychologies. And, we're complex beings, and we're not always, not always aware of everything that's going on within ourselves. For action to be complete, these 4, Venerable talked about 3, the preparation, the action, and the completion, and that's condensed from 4 branches, and I'm going to present this in terms of 4. And so there's the 4 are the first of the 4 is the object, the complete intention, which has 3 parts, the action itself, which is actually doing the thing, and then the completion of the action. So that's for every one of these 10 actions or pathways of action, we're going to go through those. So there's the object or the basis, the complete intention, which has 3 parts, which is first correctly recognizing the object or discerning it, discriminating it, the intention to do the action, and the affliction that accompanies it. And then there's the action. Third thing was the action itself, and then the 4th is the completion of the action. So if any of these are not complete, then you haven't done a complete action. And people ask questions about this all the time. And there's tons written about this. So when we've completed all four of those, that's a complete karmic action. And actually those complete karmic actions are capable of throwing another rebirth. You've planted a seed there that actually can generate a rebirth into a higher realm or a lower realm. So we're going to start with the three of the body. And the first of those is taking someone else's life or killing. And killing, the complete action is killing. And this is negative because someone's life is the thing that they cherish the most. And just as, you know, it's just so apparent, we all want to stay alive. And we don't want to have our happiness or our well-being interfered with. And in terms of, like, the level of destructiveness, this is the worst of the three physical ones. The worst one is first. That's why we learn them in order: killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. Because killing is the worst, the most destructive. Stealing is next, and sexual misconduct is next, generally. But of all of the ten, the worst of the ten, of the bunch of the ten, is wrong views, because wrong views can lead to all the other ones. The next worst of all of the ten is killing. So for these four branches, or four aspects, they usually call them branches, the object is a sentient being other than ourselves. It can be any sentient being. It can be an insect, an animal, a human being. And a sentient being is a being who is sentient in the sense of feels happiness and pain. And I'm not sure why, but they exclude fully enlightened Buddhas. Fully enlightened Buddhas are not considered sentient beings, samsaric sentient beings. I think that's what they're trying to say there. So this, when it says any being other than ourself, that means then that suicide isn't a complete karma. It doesn't mean it's like karma-free. Things that aren't complete aren't karma-free, but it isn't a complete 100%. You can't complete the branches 100% because you haven't completed the first one. And that's partly because, maybe, because usually they say the other person has to die before you do. I don't know, you're already dead. So, anyway, you can figure that out, I guess, beyond me. So that's the object, isn't it? Sentient being. And then the intention, again, has three parts. And the first one is this discrimination or recognition. So you have to properly identify or discriminate the person, not confuse one person with another. So, example, if you're trying to kill John and you by mistake kill Alex, that's not a complete karma, because you didn't discriminate the person or the being properly. So we actually have to kill the sentient being that we're intending to kill. And then Lama Tsongkhapa says, but if you have, like, you know, because, you know, sometimes people are just, they don't care who they're killing, they're just going in and I want to kill. That, in that situation, you don't need to discriminate. You have discriminated. You don't care anyone. So that would be a complete karma. That would be a complete in terms of the basis. And this is, so any of these 10 non-virtuous pathways of action, Lama Tsongkhapa says, this is the same case. If you have a general motivation, thinking that no matter what happens, you're going to do this, you know, whether it's, you know, you don't care about the discrimination, you know, I just want to kill, or I just want to steal something, or whatever it is, that's the case for all of these, that the general motivation then covers it. Does that make sense? Okay. And then there's the motivation to do the action. We're still in the second branch, the complete intention or attitude. And so in the second part of that is the motivation to do the action, and that's the motivation to kill. So, for example, sometimes we step on a bug and we weren't intending to kill a bug. We didn't even know it was there till the last moment, or maybe we didn't even know ever and we just saw it later, or maybe we didn't even see it. So that's not a complete branch there. And even in our laws we recognize that. We have distinctions, different levels of murder and manslaughter and things like that, because beings die by our actions, and we don't always have the intention of killing. And then the third of the complete intention is the presence of an affliction. And so an affliction must be present, and usually they're talking about ignorance, desire, ignorance, attachment, or anger. So this is where we get into, for most of these things, what's called a causal motivation, a timely motivation. So yeah, any of these destructive actions can be initiated with any of the three poisons, ignorance, anger, or attachment. And that's the causal motivation. But some of them are completed generally with another motivation, which is the timely motivation. So for this situation of killing, the initial motivation could be desire, like you like to eat meat, so you want to go hunting. Could be anger, like you're in a war and you're angry at these people, so hatred is involved. Or it could be ignorance, like animal sacrifice. So there's different afflictions present. But they say that the timely motivation, the one that's more happening when the action is completed, that you complete the action with for killing, is the motivation of anger, some kind of wish to destroy. So although it may have started out with one, they say it ends with that. So this is something to look in your own experience and see. So killing, harsh words, and malice are always completed with the motivation of anger, though they could be started with other ones. And then the action itself, or the performance, is another word for that. This is the doing of the action. So here in this situation, we've taken the life of another living being. It doesn't matter what the means are. It could be poison, could be weapons. It could be helping someone else to commit suicide. Or if we incite other people to kill. So even though we don't do the killing, but we incite or hire somebody else, that still counts. You still incur a full branch of the action. And even if it say you hire somebody to kill somebody and it happens 2 years later, when that person dies, you accumulate that karma. As long as you're still alive. If you hire somebody to kill somebody and you die before it gets done, but they do it, you don't accumulate that because you're not there in that specific life. And then there's the completion of the action, and this is when the other sentient being dies before we do. And then there's a part here where Venerable Children said, and you feel satisfied with that outcome. And this really got me wondering, because it's not, Lama Tsongkhapa doesn't say it that way. He doesn't include that. But then, and there are some parts about the heaviness of karma that talk about rejoicing and this and that. So I wanted to, because remember we were talking about how there's some flexibility to karma, and there's really, but basically it's just complex. There's a lot of different things going on. So here, Geshe Sopa is saying that the action will also be incomplete if your motivation thoroughly and sincerely reverses before the victim dies. For example, if you attack a man with the intention of killing him, but you change your mind before he dies and think, I do not want to see that person die, then the action won't be complete, even if the person eventually dies. When your motivation reverses like this, you can even confess and apply antidotes to purify the action before the victim dies. Of course, the action is still negative, but the results will be mitigated because the intention to kill was completely reversed before the action was complete. So that's one thing where we had this motivation, it reverses, so that affects this. And then the other one about rejoicing, because when she said, Venerable's words actually were, and she, this talk I'm using for these came out before either of these books came out. I'm amazed how correct her information is. She got this, I guess, from oral teachings. Okay, so being satisfied with that outcome, that made me think about rejoicing in something. And so, for instance, karma that is heavy because of the action, he's going to use killing for this. So how we go about doing things makes a difference. So for example, for killing, the karma of killing is heavier if, say, you kill with the attitude of joy or great satisfaction. If you praise an act of killing you have done yourself or caused others to participate in, If you do it with an attitude that is happy to see an act of killing, or if you plan the act for a long time and make elaborate preparations for it. If you perform the action constantly and repeatedly and do it avidly, each time you kill numerous beings. If you purposely kill in an especially cruel or painful way. If you kill after forcing your victim to perform improper actions out of fear. Doesn't that remind you of some things we've seen on the news? A lot of this does. If you mercilessly kill a being who is weak and helpless, who is suffering greatly, who is poor, who is pathetically moaning or pitifully wailing in pain. So these kind of attitudes actually apply to all of the actions, and these are, make things heavier. So actions are light or heavy depending on how we go about them. So this, there's a list of what those are, but we're not going to get into that into any detail, but I wanted to bring it up because I was really wondering if that was the case, and I think Venerable is exactly right that although Lama Tsongkhapa didn't mention it, when you read these longer commentaries, you see that, yeah, it, for it to be complete, you actually can reverse it by changing your motivation, so then it's not a complete branch. So when she, her words, I think, are correct. Okay. So, and we said if they die after us, it's not a complete action, right? Okay. Or if you just injure somebody, then that's not an act of killing. So then, going back to suicide, that's missing two of these branches. The object isn't there because it has to be someone else. And then the completion isn't there, yeah, because the other sentient being has to die before us. So it's not complete. Still not recommended. It's still not karma-free. It's just not complete. And so, and then we talked about accidental killing is not a complete act. And let's see. And also there are situations where people are coerced into killing, like someone makes you kill. Then you actually don't have the full motivation there if you're being forced. So that can't be a complete act. And then there's also the results of our actions. And two of those results were the... One is the habit. So any of these 10 non-virtues, doing them creates the habit of doing them. So that's... the same all the way across the board. But the one of the experience similar, the concordant experiential result, we'll just call it the experiential result, one of those is to have a short life. And then the environmental result of killing is to live in a place where there's war and strife or where food and medicine aren't potent. So you can see, just as you injure others, your body is kind of injured because you can't, you know, it can't stay healthy because there's not good food, not good medicine, things like that. Okay. There's a lot of topics that Venerable went into that we aren't going to have time for, about eating meat and abortion and, yeah, things like that. And these, this information, if you're interested in those things, you can find on our website. So the next physical act is stealing or taking what hasn't been freely given. So here the object or the basis is something that doesn't belong to us. It could be something that belongs to somebody else or it could be something that is not owned. So like in our vows, our monastic vows, we can't even steal something like a blade of grass. No one owns it. But we don't do that. Like I remember years ago I was going with Venerable Children to some house in Coeur d'Alene or Sandpoint. And they had a little chip of rubble on the ground that was of the siding that they used on this building, just this trash. And I picked it up to bring it back to the Abbey because I was thinking, oh, we might want to use this kind of siding. And then when I was in the car, I said, should I have taken that? And she said, no. Because that's not freely offered. Okay, so there's the, it's not owned by you. there's funny situations that come up, like when everything around you is kind of screwy in this regard, like when you go to India and everything in India operates on this system of making bakshi, you know, like kind of bribes in a sense. The whole economy works that way. So what do you do? You know, there's a lot of complications when you think about this and apply this to your situations that come up. So she actually asked a Rinpoche about that once, because there was a time when someone wanted her to bring a computer from Singapore to India. And at that point, the customs charge was 250% of the cost of the computer, which is insane. And she didn't want to do it. But she asked one of her teachers about that, and he said, well, because, you know, the system is messed up. She said, well, I don't know. Maybe you get 50% of the negative karma and the Indian government gets the other 50%. Anyway, kind of, you don't want to. So there's a lot of touchy situations that come up like that. So. Then there's the intention. So the second branch is the complete intention, and first was the discrimination or recognition. So this means that we actually are, you know, we steal what we intend to steal. So maybe you plan to take a TV, but you took a radio instead or something. Or maybe you borrowed something, some money from somebody, but you forgot how much you borrowed, and then you only paid half of it back. Well, that's a situation where the branch isn't complete because you haven't really discriminated properly. You've forgotten that, and you haven't really cheated them out of money completely intentionally because you forgot, right? Or maybe you borrowed something and then you forgot and you kind of thought it was yours. You know, that wouldn't be a complete recognition. It might be something else, you know, like carelessness or something like that, or spacing outness. So this is something that we're quite careful with here at the Abbey. When people come, or when we go and visit other people, we're quite careful about, you know, like, what do you use in a person's home? What's freely offered and what isn't? And generally here, we actually, when we orient people, we let them know around at least food, and, you know, we let them know these are things that you're available to you 24/7. And then we usually say, and these are, you know, in the kitchen, the things in the cupboards are not. We try to make it quite clear, partly because it's not a good place to be stealing something, which we'll get into a little bit later. So, yeah, we make a point of, and when you travel, you know, it's better to ask than wonder about these things. And then there's the motivation to do the action. You have to have the intention to steal. So it can't be like you forgot or that. And then there's the presence of an affliction. And this is usually out of attachment, because you want something for yourself. But it could be out of anger, like maybe in a war situation, they go in and plunder stuff because they're angry at these people and they just want to harm them by stealing from them. I think that happened a lot in Tibet. You know, I don't think people took a lot of the things from there because they were so interested in having them. Maybe some people wanted to make money. I think there was some probably just destruction out of anger. And then we might steal out of ignorance. Some people think it's okay to do. Hey, if I don't get caught, what's the problem? You know, that would be ignorance. Or, for instance, you might think, oh, they're not paying me enough at this job, so I'm just going to pay myself a little bit more by taking this or that. I think that's one people know. Or we might think, oh, this is a big company, it doesn't matter. Or we might think, I don't believe in everything our government does, so I don't want to pay all my taxes. You know, those are all types of afflicted states. So we need to check up on that. And then this thing about timely motivation, as we said, stealing. Or maybe I didn't say. Stealing, unwise sexual behavior, and coveting usually start, they may start with any particular affliction, but the timely motivation, when you complete the action, is usually attachment. They don't say usually, they just say it is attachment, but I think these things aren't so set in stone. And then the action itself, you know, there's so many things that can happen here in terms of stealing. You could be threatening someone you could be using things that you weren't given permission for, like photocopy machines and making long-distance phone calls. You could be overcharging people. You could be doing weights and measures and, you know, making it so it's not right. That would be stealing. Or you could be coercing somebody to give you something that still is considered a type of stealing. Putting people in positions where they can't turn you down. It's really coercive in a way that's giving you something, so it's considered stealing. And then she mentions for monastics, maybe they're passing out envelopes and you take two. That wouldn't be so good. And then the completion of the action is it's like thinking that it belongs to you, it's mine, is one way it's said. And this has a sense of ownership. And I didn't go back and check that, but I think there might be, in some of these there's different thoughts about this. I think that one also could be, it seems like I remember when we were studying the Vinaya, once you got the thing, when it was really stolen, was when the last corner of it was off, or with a piece of land, because you can't move a piece of land when you think it's mine. So there were kind of different, when a boat was tied up, remember it was tied up, and when the cord was cut to the boat or something, then it was officially stolen. Because, you know, some things are only kind of gone in part, right? Like, if this is your book and I take it and I just take it into another room, have I stolen it? Well, if I have the intention to steal it, but the moment it comes off here, the act of stealing is happening. You getting what I'm saying? Okay, so they have some things about this. Okay, and so then these kind of results that come from this, like the experiential result, the concordant one is poverty, lacking material possessions. And then the environmental result is to live in a place with many dangers, like poverty, floods, and droughts. So it's difficult to keep your possessions safe due to natural causes or due to thieves. Well, that's all pretty sensible. See how that would happen. Okay, and then the third of the body is unwise sexual behavior. And this one, there's a lot written on this in terms of the four types or four aspects, I guess I would say. An improper person, in an improper way, in an improper place, or at an improper time. And Lama Tsongkhapa has a few pages that go into a lot of detail on that. This book by Geshe Sopa has a lot on it. And after I've looked at both of those, I kind of agree with Venerable Chodron. She says, I'm not exactly sure how many of these are culturally determined and how many are naturally negative. Because when you go into reading about it, yeah, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of what parts of the body, stuff like that, that, I don't know, different time periods, I think some of these things would change. And I don't know really if some of them are really naturally negative either. I don't think so. So some of the things are. Okay, so in terms of the object, the improper person, we'll just do it in a more general way. But these are some of the main categories they talk about. Someone who is like celibate, who's a monastic. Someone who is in the custody of their parents, like a child. Someone who's related to you. Or even your own partner, if it's done, say, in front of holy images or on days when you've taken precepts, like when you take the 8 Mahayana precepts and you take the 1-day vow of celibacy. You know, on new and full moons or Buddhist holidays, people take these. So that would be an improper person. Or maybe they're sick. In the book, they talk about certain stages of pregnancy or on hard surfaces because it's harmful. It might be your wife, but it would be an improper person because the situation isn't right. And then there's improper time. And one of these, Huatisha had said this was in the daytime. And that wasn't in all of the ones, but Venerable had thought, well, yeah, maybe that would be the situation in ancient India where everybody is working all day and everybody's living in the same place and, you know, everybody's around, things like that. But the main thing around this is going outside of your relationship. So what we would call adultery. And even if you're not married, going outside of your relationship. And why is that? Because this creates a lot of pain and confusion. And especially if you have kids, it creates a lot of problems for them. It makes, yeah, it just makes a lot of confusion, and you just have to look around at your own life or other people's lives to see that that's the case. So, good to kind of, you know, if you're in a relationship and it's not going well, it'd be better to work on the relationship than to go outside of it. You know, and there's so many ways to get help in that department. Usually the problems you have, if you walk away from them, you're just going to have them again the next place you go. So it's better to try to work things out where you are. Even if the working out ends up being that the two people split, you're going to learn things in the interim. And most people would say that when you just leave something and don't try to work on something, you just take your problems with you, and then you replay them again with the next person. That's kind of like just a joke with most people. You know, the problems they had in this relationship, they just repeat them in the next one. Might as well try to learn something before you leave, or at least. Okay, then we have the complete intention. So this means you recognize the person that you're intending to have sex with, which, you know, seems like kind of crazy, but actually, in the book they talk about, they didn't know it was my wife, it was the other person's wife, but what I was thinking about was, you know, actually I remember hearing about in the old days, and probably still happening, that people would go to clubs, certain kind of clubs, and have sex, and they didn't even know who they were having sex with, you know. So this would be one of these kind of situations where recognition wouldn't matter. It's just because you're just there doing it. But, you know, I guess if it was dark and they were a twin sister or something, I don't know how that would happen. It's hard for me to imagine that one a little bit. But. Okay, and then the motivation for the action under the complete intention is the intention to have sexual engagement. And the presence of the affliction is usually attachment. And it's always completed with attachment, but it could be motivated by other afflictions. For instance, rape, I think they usually associate with anger. And there's also maybe ignorance. And some people, for instance, think, Venerable told a story in here about she was taken out. It's very common for monastics to be taken out to lunch. And she went out to lunch with some person, and they had just gotten into some kind of thing where they were using sexuality in their spiritual practice. And she just thought, well, I guess it's time for me to go home now. It was like, so that, I think we've all heard about those kind of things, and that's a kind of ignorance of really not having. That ignorance would be motivating that kind of sexual activity for 99% of people or more. And then there's the timely motivation. So it might start with any of these, but it would usually end with attachment. And then there's the action itself. And Lama Tsongkhapa calls it, you know, this is the meeting of the sexual organs. But, you know, this was, let's see, there were different things that said here. Yeah, like, Venerable had talked about, this was not one that you could tell somebody else to do have a complete karma of. You know what I'm saying? She said that wasn't the case. Or maybe it wasn't. Yeah, actually, I guess I'm mixing that up. Here's what it was. There are two books, like a Sangha and one other. One book was saying that someone could tell somebody else to, you know, do sexual misconduct and they would receive the full karma. And another text was saying that you couldn't. You tell someone else, it wouldn't be a complete karma. And then Tsongkhapa just says, you know, it's maybe just saying it's not a complete path of action, but it doesn't mean it's not a fault. So think about it. Most of these things where there's different ideas, they're coming from different perspectives. Sometimes these things are coming from Vinaya texts where they have one perspective, and sometimes they're coming from another text. So mainly, I think what for us to take from them is just to learn from them. So the completion of the action, Tsongkhapa said sexual union of the two parts is the culmination. And Venerable Chodron said the completion of the action is one experiences delight, in other words, orgasm, which in our vows, actually, for our vows to be broken as a monastic, penetration the depth of a width of a hair is all it takes, right? But then the completion of the action is another thing. So then, because there's some different ideas about that, I wanted to see if I could clarify it. So Geshe Sopa says, the culmination of the action takes place when the man and woman come together. Well, that's helpful. In the Vinaya, it says that completion of the action takes place when the two touch and experience sensual pleasure, because that's one part of it. Pleasure has to be involved. We have seen these slight differences between the Vinaya interpretations of the completion of the action and the lineage presented here, which comes mainly from a Sangha and the Abhidharma. We saw a difference in interpreting when the act of stealing is complete, which I didn't go into really fully. In the discussion of lying, which comes next, there's a question of whether a lie is complete when it is heard or when it is understood. So we find differences in these two systems. We do not need to worry about this too much. The overriding point is that we need to avoid these behaviors in these situations. So I think that's the main thing to take from this. You know, understand that there's, you know, little different ideas about things. For our vows, it's very good to be clear with what the Vinaya says. But in general, these different ideas, you know, the basic take-home message for us is to look at our own behavior and try not to get involved with these things. Okay, so with this one, the concordant experiential result was having a disagreeable spouse and marital disharmony. And the environmental result was living in a dirty place with poor sanitation and lots of misery. Okay. Now we're going to move on to speech, and we'll just do two of them tonight. And so, for these lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle talk, again, the most destructive one is first, and they are less as you go down the line. So lying is the most destructive, then divisive speech, then harsh speech, then idle talk. For lying, this is something that we usually do verbally, but it can also be done physically, like with a hand gesture or a nod of the head. And then, so when we're lying, we're denying something that we know is true, and we're being very clear about that. We're knowingly misleading others, knowingly giving wrong information or inventing up things that are false. And this is done in order to harm others, usually. And so here the object or the basis is another human being who we lie to, who understands what we are saying in our human language. And this is where another interesting thing came up, and I looked into these in a couple of ways. Because it said, you know, Venerable mentions that Lama Tsongkhapa didn't talk about lying to dogs. Like, can you lie to a dog? You know? And so, if you think about it, I actually came down to that I think you could. And I'll go through this a little bit and you'll see. So, Geshe Sopa says, because then they must have had a discussion about this, because this book was written later and these questions probably came up. If you lie to a dog who cannot understand what you say, or to a piece of stone, that is not an actual lie, is what he said. But notice he says, who cannot understand what you say. Well, we've already determined that gestures, a nod of the head, physical gestures work. And I would say animals actually understand certain things. Like, you know, like if you were, they always know it's this time to be fed, and then you fool them by getting them all ready to, oh, I'm going to take them outside, or I'm going to feed you now, and then you don't. In a sense, you've lied to them, and they know what's happening. They're understanding. So in my mind, I think that you can. And I agree with Venerable on that one. Okay, so then we have the complete intention, and the first part is the discrimination or the recognition. So we have to recognize that what we're about to say is false. We know very clearly in our mind that what we're saying is false. It's not accidental. We're not saying something that we think is true and we later find out it isn't true, you know. And so the motivation is to deceive another person, so you're intending to lie. And then the presence of the affliction, again, can be done with anger, attachment, or ignorance. So with attachment, we're maybe lying to get something for our own gain. We want something, or for somebody else. Or we might lie with anger because we want to harm someone. Or we might lie with ignorance, thinking there's no problem. Everybody lies, so no big deal here. Or everybody cheats on their tactics, so I can tell a lie and cheat on mine. Or everybody punches out of their time clock early, so I can lie and punch out. You know, and there you've done two things, lying and stealing. So you're just kind of thinking there's nothing really wrong with it. And then the timely motivation. For all four of the destructive actions of speech, lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle talk, they can be completed with any of the afflictions. So the action itself, here I want to, it's telling a lie, saying something false verbally usually. It could be a gesture, could be in writing. Another one that was mentioned is through choosing not to speak. I call that the sins of omission in my mind. But I hadn't seen that one before. So there's times where not speaking would be considered to be a lie. Although for our Vinaya purposes, that's not, you have to speak in order to incur a full fraction with our Vinaya vows. Doesn't matter if you're doing this for yourself or for others. Causing others to engage in lying, divisive speech, or harsh speech is the same as doing it yourself. And actually, that's according to Lama Tsongkhapa Vasubandhu, who says all four of the non-virtues, when you cause others to do them, are, can be complete. The most serious kind of lying would be about spiritual attainments, because this has the potential to do the most harm. It's very serious. It misleads others. Another situation that could come up is if we really don't know what we're talking about, and we just pretend that we do, so we make ourselves out to be something that we aren't, especially in the spiritual realm. That's very harmful, probably harmful in many situations. It's very harmful to lie to certain people, people who are powerful objects, so to speak, like our spiritual teachers, or to the Sangha, the Triple Gem, or to our parents. And the reason for this, with our teachers, our spiritual teachers, with the Triple Gem, and this is because of their qualities. And with our parents, it's because of how much they've done for us that makes them very powerful. And probably the most common one is to be lying to our parents, actually. So we need to be looking at this and think about it, and looking at why that comes up. It's definitely heavier if it harms someone, if it causes, you know, it's a white lie versus telling a lie that causes someone to be, you know, like put to death or harmed in some way or put in jail for the rest of their life. I mean, that's quite, there's a heaviness to that. You can, it's just obvious. Lying can include exaggerating the facts. Or sometimes our speech is sloppy. Like we'll say, everybody always does this. Or, I can't do anything right. Is that true? Anything? Can't do anything right? No, that's, I don't think so. Or we say things like, you never listen to me. I think when we hear always, never, I don't know. So these are kind of black and white statements that are a type of exaggeration. And we also say these to ourselves. Okay, the completion of the action. So, and we talked about this just briefly, but Venerable Chodron said, if the other person hears us and they understand and believe us, but then she said, if they don't believe us, it's not lying, it's just idle gossip, and it's not quite as bad. But I didn't so much find that in the other ones. Lama Tsongkhapa said, if no one comprehends the words, then speaking them is simply non-virtuous action of senseless speech. Not comprehending is different from not believing, right? So if you use lying, divisive speech, or harsh speech, and the other person doesn't comprehend them, then those are not complete branches for any of those three. So it's obvious to most people that lying has a lot of disadvantages. It creates a lot of stress in your life. It takes a lot of energy. It's, you know, with all these things, we can look at the advantages and disadvantages. I think for things that are small, it's helpful to, I personally find it helpful to look at little things. You know, why do I say that? You know, especially I'm talking about white lies. Why would something like that happen? I remember years ago when that happened here, and I've said something to Venerable Children, and there's a couple times where that's come up with her, and it's like, a lot of times it's like, I just say the quickest thing because I don't want to take up her time. You know, and I go back and review it, like, why? You know, it just comes out like quickly, like, we're all in a hurry. Those kind of situations are the ones I find the most kind of hard to deal with, because if you're in a calm situation where there's a lot of time, then I think there's a lot of intention, but sometimes it's kind of like, it's just expedient to take care of business and just say yes or no and move on. And I remember I was right over there and I called. We saw a fire, and I had to call Chris Smith and let him know. And there was something, I can't remember what happened there, as if I had to leave a message or what happened. But she asked me if I called him. And I remember something didn't happen right with it. I can't remember what it was, if I talked to his wife or not him. And I couldn't just kind of get into it all. So I just said yes. End of story. Because really, I had kind of taken care of the task, but I hadn't been able to take care of it in the way she asked. And to get into all the detail, I mean, I was in this mode of where I was being told all the time, too much detail, too much detail, too much detail. With what everything I was saying. So, you know, I quit. I don't give so much detail anymore. And, you know, it was just one of those, yeah, that was the situation. But, you know, kind of like, there's not the time to explain everything, so just yes. It wasn't exactly true, but it was, I don't know, those kind of things. I find it helpful to think about those kind of things and see how I'm functioning, you know, even if I'm not just learning that, you know, I don't need to be so stressed about this. It's just sometimes communication goes like that. It might boil down to that. But it could also be, what I always am on the outlook for is if I'm trying to cover up anything. Our value here about transparency is quite important. I think it's kind of what keeps Venerable Children being such an excellent teacher. I noticed this about her. She sometimes even lets us know when she's taken time to reveal her faults to us. You know how you want to cover up something because you don't want to have to admit it to others? I remember her saying something to us about that once. And I was like, wow, that's really how it works for her. This is how she's kept her life in line, being a spiritual teacher, is by being so transparent. You know, because once you start putting up these little slippery slope with that, so that's the thing. That's why I find it helpful to review these little things, because they're like slippery slopes. Okay, so on lying, the concordant experiential result is that you're going to be slandered and deceived, and people won't believe you. And the environmental result is that you'll live in a place with a foul odor where people are deceitful and there's a lot of fear. And so all of these, they just kind of make sense when you think about what lying is like. You know, you do feel, you don't, it's hard to trust people who lie. So yeah, there's a level of fear, deceit. Okay, and then the last one we're going to do tonight is divisive speech, which we also might call slander. And this is a kind of talking that causes other people not to get along. So it doesn't matter if you're saying something that's true that causes people to quarrel or untrue, false, that causes people to quarrel. It's still divisive speech. And it might also be lying if it's false. And then the object or the basis is people who are friendly with each other or people who have already quarreled. In the case of people who are friendly with each other, we're using divisive words so that they don't continue their friendship and they separate. And people who are already at odds with each other, we're using divisive speech so that they don't reconcile. And then with the complete intention, the discrimination is you're recognizing the people that you're talking to. You have the two that you're thinking of, right? And your motivation is to destroy the relationship or to make them quarrel, to stir up trouble, to cause some kind of division. And the affliction with these can be any of them. So, for example, you might use divisive words out of attachment. Say a couple people are in a relationship and they're getting along, but you want to be with one of those people in the relationship, so you might say something that causes them to split up so you can run off with that person, right? Or you might say divisive words out of anger because you're angry with somebody, like maybe somebody that you work with. And so you say negative things to your boss about them, right? And then those two now have like a falling out or some kind of, you know, there's problems. So then the boss gets upset with that person. And then you could take advantage of that situation, right? And that would be attachment then. And then divisive words out of ignorance. If you just don't think it's a problem, you know, like it's no problem here. Or another thing that might come up is jealousy. Maybe you're jealous about two people who get along really well. You can't bear it, so you say things that cause them to part ways. Then the action itself is the expression of the subject matter. And as we said, it could be pleasant or unpleasant, it could be true or false. It could be for your own purposes or somebody else's. You might do it directly to both people when they're together, or you might do it more subtly, going to each individually, right? So that it could happen in many ways. The culmination, the completion of the action. This was, again, there were some differences here. One, for Lama Tsongkhapa, it was the other's understanding of the divisive words that have been spoken. And then both he and Geshe Sopa quoted this, a sangha, where he says, the end of this path of action is when those who are to be divided understand the divisive words. And Venerable Chodron said, though, that the completion is when the people we're trying to divide, they don't get along. Or if they're not already getting along, you make it so they can't reconcile. So it's a difference there of them understanding the words versus it actually impacting them. So both of those are presented. So let's see. I forgot what I found in here from Geshe Sopa. He said, he quoted a sangha, the culmination is when those who you wish to divide understand what you say. And then he said, according to some interpretations, the action is complete when your statements actually cause a division between people. So it could be either. Either way, it's damaging. One of the most damaging situations would be to cause a division in a spiritual teacher and their community and their student, you know, between a spiritual teacher and their student. And why would that be? Because this is a very special relationship. It has a huge amount of potential to be a benefit, and then you're impeding a person's spiritual progress. It's also very heavy to divide a spiritual community, getting people broken up into factions. And Venerable Chodron mentioned that if a community is supposed to be supportive and helping each other's practice, but if they become divided, even feeling animosity towards another group of that division is a heavy karma. So if we're in that kind of situation, we need to try to stay neutral. We need to try to not to get emotionally, you know, having animosity. Okay, so the concordant experiential result of this, guess what? Not having friends. No surprise. And the environmental result is living in a place where it's bumpy and uneven. Travel is difficult. So I actually got through that. A lot of material, sorry about that. But that's why I spent the first week kind of giving the more general thing just to launch into all of that without an introduction. I can't really fathom. Are there any questions or comments people have about this? There's a lot to go through, but yeah.
Somebody gave a good example of lying to animals. If you lure an animal into a trap with food.
Oh, yeah. Luring an animal into a trap with food is lying, and also then it's probably going to be some kind of physical harm, too. Might end up being a bodily harm, too. Hi.
Does that include a fishing lure?
A fishing lure. As for lying?
So, I mean, you're trying to make it think that I think you're deceiving it to think it's
yeah, wrong. I think that might be more on the killing side. Yeah.
Land executed.
Yeah.
You don't actually have to kill a fish when you're fishing. A lot of people don't. They just catch them and release.
Yeah, it's just that's a level of harm, catch and release. It's not killing, but it's a level of harm.
Choosing not to speak, what would be lying in that?
Oh, well, choosing not to speak. A lot of the examples for lying are, they give these specific situations, what you have seen, what you have heard, right? So not speaking sometimes might indicate you might have seen or heard something, but you're not indicating it. So not speaking in that situation, I think, could be considered lying.
And regarding to killing, you say a fully enlightened being is not a sentient being, so
They didn't go into that. And I think what they were pointing to there is that often they make the distinction there are some samsaric sentient beings, and that's the distinction I hear made around that. I think that's what they were pointing to, is that that particular thing was written for samsaric sentient beings. It wasn't including the Buddha.
But we know the result.
But it's not a good thing to kill a Buddha. I think they didn't say any more, so I'm not positive, but the impression I got from that, it was more like a defining of making a distinction that it's a samsaric sentient being that they're referring to. But there wasn't more said, so. Any other thoughts?
Drawing the blood of a Buddha is a heinous action, so killing one has got to be right. Way beyond that.
Immediate. Yeah.
If you've taken the five precepts, I would think that these are much worse.
Okay, so the question is, if you've taken the five precepts, are these worse? There's actually two ways to look at that, and they're both helpful, I think, for us to think about. One is, I'll start with the first. If you've taken a precept, when you take a precept, you're setting your intention quite strongly, with a lot of clarity, right? That's the beautiful thing about it. And that's a very potent thing for your mind. For most of us who, when we take our precepts, the lay precepts or the ordination precepts, if we've prepared ourselves in a certain way, when you do that, it's kind of a powerful experience. You know, if you just kind of walk into it off the street and you don't know what you're doing, well, that's one thing. But if you've prepared yourself, and you get to that place and you have a lot of certainty about this. Like for me personally, when I first took refuge the first two times as a lay person, the first two, I wasn't taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. What I was responding to was the precepts. I had read Thich Nhat Hanh's book about the precepts, and especially when we took it down to the level of minerals, you know, like we need to be concerned even about the minerals of the earth, I just said, yeah, this is so true. These things we need to avoid. And it was very strong in my mind. And so for me, those were powerful experiences. I realized later that I actually hadn't really taken refuge in the Buddha. So I did it again, a third time, because I realized, oh, I need to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But for me, the precepts themselves were quite strong. So then, if you can imagine that in your mind, then when you do these activities, you kind of have something behind you that's like kind of like a fence that's going to hopefully help to stop you in the future, because you've thought about it and you've already made some determination that they're wrong, and maybe your mind was overpowered at the time, but it might help even cut into this propensity to do it again. Versus someone who has, so in that sense, they say it could be less. But in the sense of, and if you compare it to somebody who never has any thoughts about these things, then they aren't ever putting that fence up to not do it again in the future. You see what I'm saying? So in that sense, that's a little worse. You know, so, and that's for, so from that perspective, you can say it's a little better to have these precepts. And then you can make the case of, hey, you know you're not supposed to do this and you did it, so that's kind of, I don't know, what's the other argument, I guess, besides that, you know, you knew you weren't supposed to and you did it. Well, that sounds kind of bad. It sounds worse than somebody who didn't know. I guess you could say it that way. I'm not sure.
Yeah, also, though, if you do have precepts, you're more likely to regret.
Yeah.
Purify.
Yeah, if you, right. With precepts, you've learned about, hopefully, about purification, regret, and, yeah.
Aren't you accumulating good karma every time you're not engaging in those actions?
That's, yes, when you have taken precepts, that's one of the beautiful things about it, even when you're asleep, they say, because you're refraining from those activities, you're actually, you're doing virtue in a sense, because you're refraining, even though you don't have the intention in your mind at that moment, but you're carrying these with you. You know, the intention is, and it helps, you know, I think if you review them, like on the new and full moon, I really appreciate that Tenzin Kacho told me years ago about my lay precepts, to every new and full moon, to renew them. And I had never heard about that before, and I really appreciated it, because we have in our blue prayer book a way to do that. It's nice, because it makes you every couple of weeks, you think a little more carefully about these things, and then, you know, you kind of renew yourself. And I find one of the most powerful things in our community is that we do this as monastics every 2 weeks. And it reminds me a little bit of our building of Chinrezig Hall. The difference between building Gotami and building Chinrezig Hall in terms of the invoices was, with the invoices with Gotami, we let all the problems go from one invoice to the next, to the next, to the next, so it got completely confusing, right? Any little mistakes, we just carried them forward till we had a massive confusion. In Chinrezig Hall, we went through every invoice each month, which was a drag for both parties, and when we got done, we had cleaned the whole thing up, and we just started new with this really good energy. You know, we were amicable about it, but there are always half a dozen things that I was bringing up, and, you know, but it was so similar. It's like, wow, you get to start afresh every month, and then you don't collect all this garbage that then turns into chaos, right? That's what I find about doing precepts intentionally every 2 weeks. It's exactly the same for me. Instead of all this stuff accumulating and getting murky and this and that, I have to look at myself honestly every 2 weeks. I'm going to say it to the people I live with, you know. So that then these things, yeah, it keeps it more clean, clear. Not that I'm 100% clean, clear, but it's less murky.
Virtues of speech also fall under idle talk, because what we're saying are things that don't need to be said.
You know, I read something about that. Let me wait till next week and see if it comes up. I think they might be. I think they actually do. But I'll double check that. Okay, anything else? Yeah.
So under divisive speech, some gestures and such could also, just like with lying, you communicate something that you're intending to communicate.
Yeah.
Writing gestures.
I would think so. It didn't say specifically. I don't see why not. I mean, if you're communicating, you're communicating.
Under unwise sexual behavior, you said improper person, place, and time. Was there a fourth
one? Yeah. Person, place, time. No, that's place. Or that's not one of the other ones. Let me go back. Way, improper way. There we go. Yes.
And under improper person, you said someone celibate.
Yeah, like a monastic.
Or your partner when they're celibate. Or
yeah, there's a number of them. For instance, do you want in the text, in Lama Tsongkhapa's text, it says they're talking to men. So a eunuch, a man, a woman who's under someone else's care, a prostitute who's been promised to somebody else. So it was like okay to be with a prostitute, but if somebody else had paid for it and you were walking in there, that was improper. They have a lot of distinctions there that I agree with Venerable. They're not sure that all of them fit our time and place.
Does it mention someone that's not consenting? I mean, obviously, we would think that in our culture.
I didn't read Geshe Sopa completely, but there wasn't anything about that. I think that's kind of a given. I don't think it was mentioned, but I think I think that would be considered an improper person, but I don't, they didn't speak it out that way like we would now in these times, even though it was happening back then. It's clear when you read the Vinaya, it's very clear that rape was common for any. That's why the rules for the nuns are as they are, because unless you were in relationship with a father, a husband, or a son, as a woman, if you weren't in that relationship, or a bhikshuni, maybe, you were a prostitute. That's what you would be taken to be, and you would be unsafe, and rape was common. In fact, there was a really beautiful nun who the Buddha made special arrangements for her ordination because she was so beautiful they couldn't let her go out of the monastery to go to this ordination, so he changed the rules for her because they thought she would be raped. So rape is mentioned in the Vinaya stories.
Also under the fourth one, completion.
Completion.
To take delight in?
To take delight, right. That generally means orgasm, but
when somebody is doing an unwise sexual act for favors or something, and not doing it for delight, such as being a prostitute, isn't that either sentiment or...
I don't think they really considered... In the way this was written, they didn't talk about it from the perspective of the prostitute. And the way they wrote it, they didn't indicate that it was unwise sexual behavior.
Right, but even if someone was in a relationship, like somebody married can do that, and if they don't take delight, it's not a complete action.
Well, if two people are married and it's consenting, it's not unwise sexual behavior.
I mean, if they're going outside their own relationship, but not for delight, for favors.
If someone is in a marriage and they're going outside of their relationship for favors, I don't know what that even means.
Somebody's
in a relationship and they're a prostitute.
Yeah, they could even be married. I mean, you have no
idea. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't see that case. Doesn't sound so good.
It doesn't sound good. I just am wondering about the fourth one, having to do delight.
Well, what I would say about the one about delight, what I have thought about in that is, like, I would like to remain a bhikshuni the rest of my life. But if I was penetrated in rape, there's would I remain a bhikshuni? Well, there was a situation that happened to a nun who was an arhat, and she told the Buddha, she had such a strong mind, she said, I never experienced any delight with this. And he said, you're still a bhikshuni. So when I think about that, that's the thing I think about, is like how to make your mind so strong that if a situation comes up, I wouldn't lose my monastic vows. And when Venerable Chogren's taught about that, I think she thinks that it would be, in her mind, it's a non-issue. If it's a rape, she doesn't believe a person would lose their vows because they weren't consenting. Right. And with all of our vows, there's all of our vows have exceptions.
Although there was that situation with the nun in Nepal who was raped and set out by her community.
Right.
So it's a cultural thing. And also, you know, the issue of multiple wives, I mean, what is going outside of your relationship when you're the king with 20 different wives?
Right, exactly. So this is why I think she was saying that what is naturally negative and what is cultural. Like, if you actually read through here, you're going to see a lot of things that I would say, I don't see that that's naturally negative. When they talk about the parts of the body, I don't see that that's naturally negative. But I grew up in a different time and place. And even across another country, they might say, well, that is naturally negative, you know. But then if you have two different views like that, is it cultural or is it naturally negative? Well, this is where, that's why she kind of left it at that. And I think you have to, you know, the point of all this is not to have academic discernment, is to get our lives together. So, okay. I can see why they had so many pages on that. It's a big issue. So, let's take a moment again to reflect on this for our own actions of body and speech. To think about the situation in the world and how we can impact it just by making these changes within our own being. You just never know the impact of your actions, how they ripple out. So may we take this to heart for what's so obvious that we've gone through, but even then for a larger level of our own liberation. So putting it in the context, in a larger context of our karma that we're creating for our future lives. And with this understanding, may we generate renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.